If you want to turn to Matthew chapter 4, we're going to be looking there a lot. Now, we're going to be jumping around to some other places to kind of look at some of these ideas that are presented here. But our verse for this week that we have is 1 Corinthians 10:6. Now, these things were our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And as we look at the temptations that Satan put before Christ in Matthew chapter 4 and also they're recorded in Luke chapter 4, and you say, wait a minute, we had already gotten into his ministry. We're past this. We're going backwards. Well, there's a reason, a couple of reasons, several in fact, that we did things out of order. And one was to emphasize this point. Oftentimes in the Gospels, things are not in chronological order. Sometimes they're in order grouped according to a certain topic. We think about something like, well, it's football season, so we'll use that as an example. The football games are sometimes grouped according to by different people. You know, you might look at certain championships or something like that, and people might say, well, the best championship games. You know, and some people might say, well, the ones that were the closest in score. And somebody else might say, well, here's the ones that were in chronological order. And somebody else might say, well, here are the championship games with the lowest scores. And then others might say, well, here are all the championship games with an SEC team won. Well, here are all the championship games where there wasn't an SEC team. You know, and they group all these, they may group them all sorts of different ways. The one that drew the largest television audience. The one that was the closest in score. The one that came, you know, the ones that came down to the wire versus the ones that were blowout. They grouped them in different ways and not always chronologically. But sometimes we come to the Gospels and we read through the Gospel accounts and we just assume that everything in those Gospel accounts was this happened this day, this happened the next day, this happened the next, and it's all chronological order. And that's not the case. Sometimes they skip around a little bit. And that's the case with the temptations of Christ that are presented by Matthew and Luke. They both present the same three temptations, but they present them in a different order. And you can debate with scholars all day and all night which one did it in the order that they actually occurred in and which one grouped it in a different order for some reason, or what that reason might have been. I've heard people argue, you know, Matthew is the one that did it in chronological order, that this one happened, then this one, then this one. And somebody else said, no, Luke is the one because at the beginning of his gospel he says that I am going to set these things in order. And so that means his is in order. And, you know, it doesn't matter, okay? The fact of the matter is sometimes skeptics of the Bible will say, hey, these things are contradictions in the Bible. Because Matthew says 1-2-3 and Luke says 1-3-2. Well, that's not really a contradiction. Just because they record the same events in a different order, they write it down in a different order, that doesn't mean that they are contradicting one another. Because neither one of them said it happened this one and then this one and then this one. And if anybody says it was any different than that, they're wrong. They just say, these are the three temptations that Christ faced. Okay? And so, that's really kind of, that's our side note, okay? That's not even the key that we want to get at, but I just did want to point that out because sometimes people try to attack the Bible with these spurious arguments that really have no weight whatsoever, but they throw them out there like it's just proving that the Bible must not have been inspired by God. That this is a real problem for us to have to deal with, and it's really not. Not any kind of problem at all. Just like if I asked some of the college football fans what games they watched yesterday. Well, some of them might say, well, the first game in the morning was this one, and then I watched this one, and then I watched this one, and then the late game was this. And other people might say, oh, well, you know, the best game yesterday was such and such, and then, oh, yeah, and I also watched this one and this one. And some would say, I didn't watch any. But we get some different answers sometimes because of people's different perspectives. As we think about the temptations that Jesus faced, and these three in particular. And we want to focus on, particularly today, we're going to be focusing on the lust of the flesh, desire, our physical desires. And that was one of the things that Satan tempted Jesus with, was physical desire. And it's certainly nothing to be taken lightly. But as we do that, we're going to have a little bit of an introduction to this whole concept. Sometimes we feel so overwhelmed by Satan's temptations. We feel like, well, he's just attacking us from all these different directions. And so we want to try to confront some of that a little bit too. Because I want us to be able to tackle these problems that Satan puts before us. I want us to be able to jump over the hurdles that he puts in our path. And we want to do that by beginning to understand, first of all, even here in the introduction, we want to understand one thing. Satan only has three ways to attack us. Now that seems odd. We say, well, no, he attacked over here and he did this and that. And well, look at 1 John 2:15 through 17. John says, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. He's not saying don't think the sunrise is beautiful. Or, that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about worldliness, things of the world as far as sinful things of the world, not natural things that God created. So we need to understand that. But he says, if any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world. Now remember that. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Now remember, God so loved the world that he gave his only Son. Remember that? We talked about that a couple weeks ago. God loved the world and wanted to save it. And we need to love the world in that sense as well. But when he's talking here about loving the world, he's talking about loving the sinful things of the world. Worldliness is the focus here. For all that is in the world. Now notice now he's going to start a list. The lust of the flesh, and the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world passes away, and the lust thereof. But he that does the will of God abides forever. So let's notice those again. Lust of the flesh, and that's the one we're going to deal with first. The lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Basically what John tells us is, everything, every sinful thing out there is encompassed by those three ideas. Now, sometimes it may be a mixture of two of them or even all three of them involved in these things. But if you challenge yourself to think about every sin that you've ever committed in your life, it's going to fall into one of those categories or a combination of one of those categories. It was either a fleshly desire, or it was something that enticed your eyes, or it was something that just got your ego going, arrogance kind of got you into that sinful situation. Or some combination of those. That's all Satan's got. Those three things. That's it. And when we understand that, we'll be better able to face his challenges that he sets before us. Because when we see a temptation in the future, we say, okay, which one is this? Because we need to handle them a little differently depending on which one it is, don't we? I don't want to run the football analogy into the ground because I know some of us aren't big football fans, because I'm one of those that didn't watch a game yesterday. I was like Bobby, I was working. But some of us, we may not be big football fans. But football teams are different. And when a team is preparing to play another team, they look for what that team's strengths and weaknesses are. And one team may be really good with offense, and one team may be really good running the ball, and the other team really good in offense, but they're good at passing the ball. And one team may not be so good on offense, but they're really good on defense. And so you have to prepare for which one you're going to be facing. Now we need to prepare and be prepared to handle all the different attacks that Satan may throw at us. But if we understand what they are, then when we see a temptation, we can now up. That one's lust of the eyes. I've got to handle that. This one, oh, that's pride of life. I've got to watch out for that. And when we know where it's coming from and what the difficulty that we're facing is, we can better overcome it. And we want to understand as well here, Genesis 3:1-6. Satan's temptations, his attacks, are not anything new. He didn't just come up with these in the last few years. He's using the same three attacks that he has always used all the way back to the very first sin with Adam and Eve in the garden. Look at that in Genesis 3. The serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field. He said to the woman, "Has God said you shall not eat of every tree of the garden?" The woman says to the serpent, "Oh, we can eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but the tree that's in the midst of the garden, God said, you shall not eat it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die." So she said, "Yeah, God said we can eat all the trees except that one." He said, "Don't mess with that one." And so what happened? The serpent immediately says, "That's not true. You shall not surely die. God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes shall be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." Huh. Well, that's very different from... God said, "I'm going to die." Serpent saying, "I'm going to be like God." Well, aren't we supposed to be like God? Being like God's a good thing, right? So maybe I should eat that fruit so I can be more like God. Can you imagine the kinds of thoughts that went through her head as he's presenting these things to her? And notice verse 6. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, there's that lust of the flesh, isn't it? And then the next thing she noticed was that it was pleasant to the eyes. You ever seen, you know, some foods just look good and some don't? Well, this fruit apparently just looked good. Hanging there on that tree. So she has the lust of the eyes. And it was a tree to be desired to make one wise. There's that pride of life. The pride of wanting to be wise. So we got all three. He used all three encapsulated in that one temptation to try to get Eve. And he succeeded, didn't he? She gave in. She got the fruit and she ate it, and then she gave it to Adam and he ate it. And so the fall was complete. And Satan, with those three temptations, those three types of temptation, started his reign as prince of the air, prince of the earth. He started ruling over all the folks because everybody would fall to one of those temptations. And we were there too, weren't we? We've all fallen to one of those three, probably all three of them at one point or another in our life. It would be rare for somebody to not fall to each of those different kinds of temptation. But this is something that Satan has been doing for a long time, and he's gotten really good at it. He started with Eve, though. It's nothing new. So let's look at some things. Let's learn some things. First of all, let's learn that Jesus... As we come back to Matthew 4 now, Jesus knew how to fight Satan. Now, this is not going to be anything shocking to you. You've probably heard it 100 times before or more. How did Jesus conquer Satan? In Matthew 4, 1 through 11, and Luke 4, 1 through 13, what did he do to overcome each of those temptations? Each time when Satan tempted him, he came back at Satan with a scripture, with something that God had said, God had written. Now see, Eve started there, didn't she? Eve started, well, he said we shouldn't eat of... Well, then the devil gave her a comeback and she didn't have anything else that God had said to counteract that, so she gave in. How important is it for us to know God's Word? It is our primary defense against the temptations of Satan. It is our first line of defense to keep Satan's attacks from getting us to fall to sin. It's the first thing that we have to do. And if we don't know Scriptures, if we don't know what God has said is right and wrong, if we don't know what God has said we should do, then we're going to be totally unprepared to fight back against Satan's temptations. That's one of the things that concerns me most about the decreasing amount of Bible knowledge that we have as Christians. Because if we don't know those scriptures, we are not going to be able to... Whether it's false doctrine and false teaching and corruptions of worship and doctrine, or whether it's in our personal lives of individual sins that are given to these three categories. Whatever it is, if we don't know scriptures that can help us to, first of all, to recognize what is right and wrong, so that we know that I shouldn't do that. I firmly believe that there are a lot of Christians who know so little of the Bible that sometimes they commit sin not even knowing that what they're doing was a sin. Because they've not read enough of the Scriptures and understood enough of the Scriptures to know that those things are wrong. Ignorance isn't bliss. Ignorance of the Scriptures will lead to our destruction. We've got to know the Bible. We've got to learn it. We've got to grow in it and study it more and more. But each time as Jesus, under the worst of circumstances, he hadn't eaten anything for 40 days. You know he was weak and tired and cranky and ready, and not ready for an attack, you would think. You know, Satan doesn't attack you when you can best fend him off. You see, Satan isn't going to spend a lot of time while we're right here studying the Bible together. He's not going to spend a lot of his time attacking us right here, right now. He's going to attack you this evening after you've had a long day and, you know, we've eaten and we've come back and you're just tired and you've had a long day, and that's when he's going to attack you. He's going to attack you after you've worked that double shift and hadn't had any sleep in 48 hours. That's when he's going to try to get... He doesn't get you when you're the strongest. But Jesus knew how to fight Satan, because even at his most vulnerable... Most of us, if we hadn't eaten for 40 days, how vulnerable would we be? Especially to this attack. You remember the attack that came first? If you're really the Son of God, why don't you just turn one of these pieces of stone into bread so you can eat it? Now, Jesus multiplied fish and bread for people to eat. Jesus did all sorts of miraculous things. God had water come from a rock for the children of Israel, had manna fall from the sky. What's so bad about he hadn't eaten anything in 40 days. His fasting time is over. Wouldn't it have been okay for him to just turn that rock into a piece of bread and eat it? What would have been so bad about that? Well, most of us would say, well, that's no big deal. But Jesus recognized that what Satan was trying to do was to get him to sin. First of all, he was trying to get him to break his fast in a way other than what Jesus had determined was the way that his fast would be broken. He was trying to get him to do something different. He was trying, in essence, to get him to break a vow. Now, we don't read about Jesus vowing that he wasn't going to eat for a certain amount of time or anything. But Jesus had probably... How many of us have ever done that? We've said to ourselves, you know, I'm not going to have that second cookie or slice of cake or whatever. And then, a few minutes later, it's still sitting there. And we're, you know, one more wouldn't be so bad. We determined. We said we weren't going to do it, and then we did it anyway. Now we say, well, that's not... You know, I didn't break any of God's commandments. The point is, though, that Jesus had made a vow, in essence, between him and the Father of how he was going to behave himself during this time in the wilderness. He was going to be fasting. He was going to be praying. He was going to be meditating on God's Word. And Satan interrupts that to try to get him to stop fasting and eat something. And not just eat something. You know, notice, Satan didn't just bring a turkey sandwich with him, you know, or a cup of steaming hot chicken soup with him, or something like that. He says, why don't you turn that stone into bread? He's trying to get Jesus to use his miraculous abilities selfishly for the fulfillment of the flesh. So instead of the Spirit ruling over the flesh, he's trying to get him to get the Spirit to be subservient to the flesh. It's a totally different concept, isn't it? All right. We got to move along. Jesus knew how to fight Satan, though. He answered him back with Scripture. And in Genesis 3, 14 through 15, God cursed Satan and put that enmity there. And that enmity remained there all the way through to this time, and that enmity between man's seed and Satan remained, and Jesus came and crushed the serpent's head. He just demolished him. Now let's notice the second thing real quick. This is so important for us to understand. You remember, well, I know the younger folks don't, but for those of us who aren't the younger folks, you remember old Flip Wilson? The devil made me do it. Guess what? That's a lie. One of the things the devil tempts us to believe is that he made us do it. He didn't make us do it. He can't make us do it. The devil, Satan, can't force us to sin. If he could force sin, he would have forced Jesus to sin. He can't force somebody to sin. All he can do is entice them, threaten them. He can use all, but he can't force somebody to sin. And we think about Job chapter 1 and verses 9 through 12. Satan answered the Lord and said, "Oh, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge about him and about his house and about all he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands. His substance is increased in the land. Put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, and he'll curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "All that he has is in your power. Only upon himself do not put your hand." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now you think about that. Satan had to ask God's permission to take away and tempt Job. God allows us to be tempted. He always puts a limit on Satan, however. When Satan comes back, he says, "Oh, well, Job still loves you because he's got his health." But you take away his health, and so God says to him, "Okay, you can touch him, but do not kill him." Again, God put the limit on it. Satan, as odd as it may seem, we think about, now wait a minute, Satan is a rebellious, he's gone against God, he's the father of lies, he's a murderer from the beginning, all these things. How is it, what are you talking about? He can't do something? That's right. When God says, "You cannot do this," Satan can't do it. And God has made it such that Satan cannot force us to sin. Well, what about addictions? People that are addicted, they can't help themselves. Well, first of all, they can. People can overcome addictions. But secondly, how did they become addicted? They became addicted by free will. They first chose to go into that sinful thing and get addicted to it. They didn't say, "Well, I'm going to go get addicted." But they chose to go get involved in that addictive sin. And that's how they got caught by it. Satan didn't force them. And he doesn't force even those that are addicted to things. I know a lot of people who have overcome all sorts of addictions. That they, if they want to, and they'll come to God, and they can do it. Any of us could, if we would just come to God and fight against that instead of giving in to it over and over again. 1 Corinthians 10, 12 through 14, of course, Paul talks about being aware when we think we're standing, because if that's the very time we might fall. When we're not being careful. When we think there's no danger anymore. That's when it's the most dangerous. Because our pride will cause us to be lifted up and then fall. But verse 13, he says, "There is no temptation taking you but such as is common to man. God is faithful. He will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way of escape that you can bear it. So he tells them, he says, yes, you're going to face temptation. And they are common temptations. You're not tempted extraordinarily like nobody else on earth ever has been. The temptations that you fall into in your life and that I've fallen into in my life are just like the temptations everybody else has faced. Just like the ones Jesus faced, and he didn't fall to any of them. But he says God always gives you that way of escape. Now I'm going to be honest with you. Sometimes that way of escape may be death. Now, that's not a very pleasant way to escape sin, is it? But you remember Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? They were told, bow down to the idol. And they said, no, king, we can't do that. King said, I'm going to give you one more chance, bow down. Or I'm going to throw you in fire. I'm going to kill you if you don't do it. What was their way of escape? To go into the fire. Now, most of us would have said, well, you know, you just bow down one time. And just bow down, but don't really mean it. You know, just pretend to do it. Don't really mean it. Don't really worship the idol. Just you know, so the king doesn't know the difference. That's the kind of way we'd think, oh, that's not God's way of escape. God's way of escape is to not sin. Now, sometimes that may mean death. Now, in that case, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were willing to go to death. But God rescued them. God didn't always rescue people. What about Stephen? What about James? God didn't always rescue people. Sometimes he actually did call on them to be faithful to death. Just like Revelation 2:10 tells us we should be. Sometimes that may be the way we have to go. Think about this shooting in Oregon. Guy lines everybody up and asks them, you know, what religion are you? And he shoots them. How easy would it be to say, oh man, I'm an atheist like you, or whatever, you know, I don't believe, oh, I'm not any of these religions. And then he wouldn't shoot me. How hard do you suppose it was for the first person that says I'm a Christian and he shoots them in the head and they die? And then the next one says, well, I'm Hindu, and so he shoots them in the leg. And then the next person that's, you know, maybe I should say Hindu instead of Christian. So I just get shot in the leg instead of in the head. How hard is it to take that way of escape? Sometimes it's not pleasant. The way of escape is not always the easy. In fact, it's never the easy way out. The easy way is just, oh, go along with the temptation and give in to it and sin. That's the way Satan plans it. But God gives us that way of escape if we'll look for it. He provides it. All right, let's quickly now. Number three, God's law is what Satan always attacks. No matter what the temptation is, what Satan is really attacking is our belief in God's law. Are we really going to do what God's law says? Do we really believe what God's law says? And that's what he attacked with Jesus in Matthew 4 and verse 6. And he even misused Scripture there. To try to say, well, but didn't the Bible also say this? And he will do that. And he'll get your friends and relatives to do that, you know, to twist Scriptures and misuse them to try to get you to do things. 2 Corinthians 2:9 through 11. He says, for to this end also did I write, that I might know the proof of you, whether you be obedient in all things. To whom you forgive anything, I forgive also. For if I forgive anything, to whom I forgive it, for your sakes forgive I it in the person of Christ, lest Satan should get an advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices. Be obedient in all things, and don't be ignorant of Satan's devices. He will get us by attacking God's law and twisting it. Isn't that what he did in Genesis? God said you will die. No, you won't really die. He's attacking God's law. In Genesis 3, 3 and 4. In 2 Thessalonians 2, 7 through 10 also. The mystery of iniquity is already at work. And here's a case. The King James says, only he who now letteth. And what it actually means is the one who's preventing it. Doesn't mean he's letting it happen. The one who's preventing it will continue until he's taken out of the way, and then the wicked one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the spirit of his mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming. Even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders. You think about that, that power and signs and lying wonders that Satan stuck out there for people to trip over and to not do what they should do because they were deceived by these things. With all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish. Because, notice what he says, because they received not the love of the truth so that they might be saved. Satan loves for us to be ignorant of God's truth. He wants us to not know God's law. That will get us every time. And then we want to notice, we're talking about those Israelites that were our example. We mentioned that from in the passage we read in 1 Corinthians. But they could have overcome Satan. They could have won, but they didn't. They failed for the same reason that a lot of times we fail. Numbers 11, verses 31 through 34. There was a wind came and it brought in so many quails. It's hard to imagine. Okay, 2 cubits is probably about 3 feet, about a yard high, about 3 feet high. There were quail laying a day's journey on all sides of the camp. So if you start in the middle of the camp and you walk for a day, I don't know how far you could walk in a day. A day is pretty good walk. You get a pretty good walk in. And all around the camp, for as far as you could walk in a day, there was 3 feet of quail piled up. That's a lot of food. And the people went out and they gathered it up. But their desire, their lust of the flesh, because they wanted some meat so bad, they didn't come back to the camp and clean it and cook it like they were supposed to and drain the blood like the law taught them to. They just started in eating it. And the Bible tells us there that while the flesh was yet between their teeth, before it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was kindled and he smote them with a plague because they let their desire of the flesh overcome them. Psalm 106, verses 11 through 15, talks about it as well. It says, then they believed his words, and they sang his praise, but they soon forgot his works. They waited not for his counsel, but they lusted exceedingly in the wilderness and tempted God in the desert. And he gave them their request, but sent leanness into their soul. You know, sometimes God will let you have your fleshly desires. But what happens when you feed the flesh? You starve the soul. And that's what they get. He gave them the request. He gave them, they wanted that meat so bad. He gave it to them. But you know what it cost them? Their souls became leaner and leaner. If you're going to feed something, you need to feed your soul. I'm reminded of the old story of the Indian grandfather and his grandson, and the grandson is struggling with sinful desires. And his grandfather's explaining it to him that basically there are two wolves living inside you. And one wants what's good and one wants what's evil. And they're fighting against each other to see which one will win. And the grandson says, Granddaddy, which one's going to win? And the grandfather says, the one that you feed. Because that one's going to get stronger. And the one you starve is going to get weaker. How easy it is, though, for us to have some desire. And the biggest problem with it is that so many of our desires. God created us with a desire to eat, didn't He? He created us as human beings, male and female, to have natural sexual desires. He created us to want physical companionship. He created us with a desire to be comfortable, more comfortable at a certain temperature than other temperatures. He designed us so that, you know, we're more comfortable sitting on a comfortable couch than out working in the field, right? He designed us that way. But then He told us to control those desires. So we're not supposed to just sit on the couch all day. We need to labor with our hands. Yes, there is sexual nature to human beings, male and female, but that's for marriage. Yes, food is good, but we need to eat the right kinds and the right amounts, and we have to say no sometimes to ourselves. Yes, it's nice to be in a climate-controlled room, but we've still got to go out and do things. Now, so we have these desires, and the desires themselves many times are not bad in and of themselves. But it's our misuse of them, and Satan tries to twist those natural things that God's created and turn them to something evil. And that's what He did with Jesus. Was Jesus saying it's a sin to eat bread because He wouldn't turn the rock into bread? No, He wasn't saying it was a sin to eat bread. Jesus ate bread on numerous other occasions. Why wouldn't He do it there? Because Satan wanted Him to. Sometimes it's just because Satan wants you to do it, you know you shouldn't. If Satan's trying to tempt me to do this, then I shouldn't do that thing. Even if I don't necessarily understand why he wants me to do it, or why it would be bad to do it. If he wants it, he never wants us to do things that are right and good. So I have you the question to think about this week. Are you winning in your battle against the devil's dirty device of desire? How are you doing with that? Do you need some help with that this morning? Are you struggling? If you have a need to respond to God's invitation, either in initial obedience to Him, or if as a Christian you've fallen to some of those temptations that Satan has put before you, and you need to get back out of that, and you need to come back to the Lord and be cleansed of those sinful things. Whatever need you may have, please respond as we stand and as we sing.